welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening, David.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm pissed.
Oh, why?
Because for now the third time, the Warner Brothers under the error-filled and tyrannical reign of David Zaslav has shelved a finished movie.
First, and I have no idea why.
It's because it's not... They figured out they could make more money not releasing it as some sort of insurance or thing or tax thing. I don't know what it is. But this gets to, we did this as a top-of-the-show topic when they canceled Batgirl. I think it was with you.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Warner Brothers is no longer a film production company.
I know.
It's like... I think I said the same thing last time. There's an episode of Silicon Valley where your friend and mine, Stephen Tobolowsky, tells Richard, like, Pied Piper, your algorithm is not the product.
Right.
The stock is the product.
Right,
and
absolutely.
That's how David Zaslav is running Warner Brothers, and it means that now, and not to be, like, obviously personal tastes are going to come into it. This, I'm pissed about this on principle.
Yeah.
Of the three, this is the first one that I'm like, fuck, I really wanted to see that.
So I know there was Batgirl.
And then
what
there was
the other one?
Scoob. It was
a
Scooby movie. That can't remember what it was called. Scoob Haunting. It was like a scary Scooby movie.
Yeah.
They're all kind of scary. I mean, they're not actually scary.
Yeah,
they're all
scare
adjacent.
Thank God they pull those masks off at the end.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd just be shitting my pants.
Yeah, nightmares for the rest of your
life.
Exactly. But this one, it's Coyote versus Acme.
It sounded great.
And it's, an animation live-action hybrid in which the Wile E. Coyote attempts to sue the Acme Corporation. That's such a great idea.
It's a great premise.
I also, I'm a big Looney Tunes head, and Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons are often among my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I just love the... the lack of dialogue is always great, and seeing which ridiculous ways the coyote's going to get thrown off a cliff or smashed by a rock or whatever, just it still makes me laugh. And here's a controversial take. Hot take. Roadrunner, cooler than Bugs Bunny. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Every once in a while, those fucking tortoises get the best Bugs Bunny.
Sure.
Nobody beats the Roadrunner.
That's true,
the Roadrunner
always
wins.
Yeah. Sounds vaguely threatening when you put it that way. But it's once upon a time. I remember when I would use the term studio calculation to talk specifically about how a movie is made. But now it has a totally different meaning. It's literal calculations and determining whether a movie can even be seen.
Yep.
And that is so...
depressing?
That's so dispiriting. It's so fascinating. What's going on over there?
You keep talking.
Okay. I watched a YouTube video recently. It was like an hour and a half. And it was like who killed cinema? And so he goes through like all the... And he treats it like a whodunit.
Uh-huh.
And so he goes through all the suspects, and it's like, the death of the movie star. Like, all stuff that we've talked about on here. Mm-hmm. And then, Marvel, but not Marvel specifically. That's just more, like, emblematic of a larger issue, which is, like, thinking purely in terms of franchises. And literally, at one point, he just goes, David Zaslav.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't even say, like... And I don't think he even said, like, oh, he's emblematic of a specific type of executive. Like, this is a new kind of executive. This is... I mean, I'm always fascinated by, like, the history specifically of television and just seeing, like, how big of a role a corporate guy can play for good or ill. And this guy, man... I just don't understand. I mean, I do understand, but I don't understand why he was put in charge of the company.
Yeah, I mean, I understand on paper, but I don't understand. And I'm kind of made my peace with not understanding why people like him exist, like how they come about.
I know.
What joy do they get out of life? Like, it's a fundamentally different way of thinking about life.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, hey, I'm pro-capitalism, but at the same time, you got to adapt to the fucking business you're in. And in his mind, it's like every kind of business out there is exactly the same and can be approached exactly the same. But at the same time, it's like, yes, but you do recognize that this is a very specific kind of customer base. And if they get word that you are holding back a product that they might want to engage with, like, they're going to be furious.
And, well, not just the, let's say customer, the audience.
Well, I wanted to speak purely in market terms.
Yes, okay.
Because I'm sure that's how he does.
Yeah, so, yeah, right. Yeah, so not only the customer, but, like, if you're a named director and you have your choice of studios, like, is there any reason to go with Warner Brothers right now?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this was, I mean, yeah, Dave Green, the director of Coyote versus Acme, is not a huge name. He did the second of the Michael Bay produced Ninja Turtles movies. But the movie was produced by James Gunn, who, in theory,
and I think I
has
saw
a lot
that
of sway at. Should have a lot of sway at WB, at Warner Brothers, but apparently not enough to save a movie that, by all accounts, among the people who did see advanced screenings, was very good.
I mean, just... I was gonna... Again, like, this is just me not thinking in a corporate way. Part of me is just like, oh, just throw it on a streaming service. If you feel like it's not going to be worth a theatrical release, just do that. But it's like, well, I'm not even thinking in terms of like, oh, let's just count it as a loss completely. And in order to do that, we can't show it to anybody.
Yeah.
And it is a very craven way to approach this whole situation. And it is increasingly very depressing. And I do hope that at some point, Warner Brothers, like, comes to their senses, and they're like, this guy is ruining our brand, you know, to keep other corporate speak going. This guy is ruining our brand. We got to get rid of him.
Yeah, he's ruining the Warner Brothers brand. He's our trying, he's tried as hard as he can to ruin HBO as a brand, which is insane. Like, I mean, what brand name in television has more cachet than HBO?
Yeah.
Insane.
I mean, Hallmark, I guess. Hallmark, I guess.
The greeting card people?
What was that? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, I'm furious, but I do think if it does hurt the brand in enough, in a way that the shareholders see a decline in value, then Zaslav will hopefully be
ousted,
kicked out of this, ridden out of this town on a rail.
Yeah,
not welcome in Hollywood ever again. And maybe they'll put out all these movies.
So they salt the floors of his office.
we'll get to see Scoob and Batgirl, and most importantly, Coyote versus Acme, or whatever one he decides to cancel next.
Yeah, it's. I am grateful though that like. You know, this, it does make you wonder, like, are there any that that haven't been released that we didn't hear about? Because we've heard about all of them so far. And I'm glad that, like, there are people out there that are sort of finding this out and reporting it. So,
People know what movies are in production.
I think so, yeah.
But isn't there, I'm trying to think what else is, like, a Warner Brothers, like, doesn't Adam Wingard have another Godzilla movie on the way? Like,
I believe
that could end up.
I think there's a like a series.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's for Apple TV. It's called Monarch, which is like the company that deals with kaiju and stuff.
Yeah, no, I know. I've heard of that because I've seen ads for it. No, I think there's also a because Adam Wingard did Godzilla versus Kong.
Yes,
and I thought he was doing another Godzilla related movie, or maybe it was another Kong related movie. Let's see. Upcoming projects. 2024 Godzilla X Kong. I don't know, Godzilla times Kong. The New Empire.
All right.
Rebecca Hall, Dan Stevens, Brian Tyree Henry. Yeah, this is, I guess, supposed... So, yeah, this...
Yeah.
If we... Maybe we'll never see Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. I mean, if we do see it, hopefully we don't see it under that name.
Maybe the X is meant to be, like, hugs. Like XOXO. Godzilla hugs
Godzilla
Kong.
Godzilla hugs Kong.
Yeah. It's like, wow, they really made a lot of progress since the last movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is very depressing.
Godzilla and Kong sitting in a tree. All right. Yeah, let's... Let's move on to something more positive, which is TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Today, I was listening to and loving... It's an album that is now 20 years old. The album is called The Earth Is Not a Cold Dead Place. The band is Explosions in the Sky. Mm-hmm. I know, Tyler, I know you like Explosions in the Sky, even if you don't remember who that is. They did the score for Friday Night Lights, the movie.
Oh, that is a good score.
Yeah.
So, I also just like Explosions in the Sky.
Yeah. But, that kind of, like, soaring post-rock. Like, Explosions in the Sky have done things since, and they've always been good, but, like... Going back to this album that's 20 years old, and going, holy Christ, they were really in the groove.
There's a they remind me of like This Will Destroy You, which is kind of that.
I don't know that.
Oh, the band?
No,
I think it's called. I'm pretty sure it's called This Will Destroy You. It's like all instrumental stuff.
Yeah.
Some of it, and it often has like quite a build over the course of like an 8-minute song. A song of theirs called The Mighty Rio Grande is featured prominently in Moneyball. They're wonderful. And so I think if you like Explosions in the Sky, you should check out This Will Destroy You. I think you'd like it a lot.
Sorry
about that.
I'm sure it'll all sound great on your TweakedAudio.com earbuds that are available at a low, low price at TweakedAudio.com. But if you use the offer code PRETENSION at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to TweakedAudio.com and use the offer code PRETENSION.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler, we're back.
Yeah.
Let's get into it, shall we? What are we talking about?
Okay. I don't even know where to start, because this topic is one that I'm sure in many ways has been beaten to death. I don't... when I first thought of it, I was like, surely we've talked about this before. And maybe we have.
I mean, we've touched on it. I don't think we've done it as an episode. But, you know, a lot of our listeners have better memories than we do.
Yeah, boy, that's for sure.
And we'll say, hey, you did this already.
Next week, let's do another... let's do an episode about Shakespeare in film. See how that goes.
We've never done that. We've never done that twice.
Yeah. You know, I'm watching a lot of stuff these days. I'm watching newer movies. I'm watching TV shows. I'm trying to catch up on older movies. But then every once in a while, I get this desire to just kind of revisit a movie that I've seen before, sometimes several times. And it just got me thinking, well, of course, and I run into that dilemma that every movie person does, which is, and especially in the critic world, which is like, do I watch a new movie that I haven't seen?
Yeah, new to you.
New to you, or even just a movie from this year, so you can be like part of that conversation. Do I watch that, or do I watch an older film that I've already seen? And you know, sometimes if you pick the one you've seen, it feels almost irresponsible. Because, like, oh, but I've got to have an opinion about this movie or that movie or whatever.
Or just how can I rewatch a movie I've seen multiple times when I still haven't seen whatever your huge blind spot is, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely struggle with that, and I definitely tend to err on the side of watching something I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that's necessarily the best way to be a movie lover. I think there are rewards that come from rewatching movies.
Right.
And that's why I haven't done it in a while, but I have like go-to rewatches that are like,
sure,
like comfort food movies.
Yeah.
I know you and I feel very differently. Like we both like Goodfellas, but we tend to react to it in very different ways.
Right.
Goodfellas is a comfort food movie for me. You find it too upsetting.
I don't see how you can see like the last 30 minutes of that movie and be like, ah, this is nice.
It's stirring the sauce, and Janet's got the diamonds in her hair, or whatever.
That's right. Helicopters.
At this point, it's sort of like, I mean, like the more you watch something,
yeah. So it's just the familiarity with it.
But also, I can focus on what's like funny about it. Like, sure, Goodfellas is a funny movie.
Yeah, that's true.
It's the same way that like I've watched There Will Be Blood so many times that like I am half just watching it as a comedy.
Yeah.
At this point, which I don't think is wrong. Paul Thomas Anderson's movies are always funny.
Always.
But I think there is a difference between like go-to comfort food, and then like rewatching something that is very intellectually stimulating.
Right.
Like I've seen Uncle Boomy, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, multiple times, and it's not in the same way as I like, oh, I'll throw on Uncle Boomy. Like it's
sure,
there's an intentionality to it. That's like I am thinking about like I miss the feeling, or I have more I think I can uncover by watching this.
Yeah.
I'll sit down and intentionally watch it, as opposed to the No Country for Old Men or something, which I just like, that's a perfect like throw on movie, you know?
And it's so interesting, like for you and I, it is, I'm sure for most people, they'd be like, ugh, it's like I watched that once and so depressing and weird.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is so like, this got me just thinking about why we rewatch movies. And then that goes to like, should we rewatch movies? And then that goes to, were movies made to be rewatched? And if so, is that kind of a ripoff? Not financially, but just like, and it just got me thinking about like the history of film exhibition. Because
what's a ripoff, though?
Oh, just the idea of like almost a filmmaker saying like, yeah, they might not like it the first time, but I'll intrigue them just enough to get them to watch it a second time, maybe a third, and then they'll like it. And it's just like, I think...
Well, did you see James Cameron responded to like runtime complaints for The Way of Water, like of not having an intermission and everything? And he was like, he said something like, just go to the bathroom, you have to go to the bathroom. Whatever you miss, you'll see the next time you come see it.
Yeah. And that's amusing, but also... You know, in the early days of film, before TV, really the only way to see movies was in the theater. And yes, people would go see the same movie over and over again. It's one of the reasons why Gone with the Wind was so successful, as people would see it over and over. Thus, you know, at that point, I think you could say a significant percentage of their lives was spent watching Gone with the Wind because it's so damn long.
That reminds me, I know I've told this story on the podcast before. My mom, when she was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
worked at a movie theater. And the movie theater had like a main screen and then either one or two small screens. And the one or two small screens would flip over every week or two.
Yeah.
But the entire year, she worked for a year.
Yeah.
There were only two movies in the main theater, Sting and The Godfather Part Two.
The Sting, that's right.
The only two movies.
Yeah.
My mom has seen The Sting. She still considers it her favorite movie, last time I asked, and has seen it like scores of times probably because of that.
Nothing wrong with that.
Movies used to stay in theaters longer, I guess is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
What we're saying.
And so that's the thing is, I do wonder, and I'm not really sure, I'll stick primarily with like American movies right now, and then we can branch out later. I wonder if American films were maybe a little bit more. It sounds insulting. A little bit simpler back then, because at that point, a filmmaker couldn't really guarantee that people would see their movie a second time. Whereas now, I think there are plenty of filmmakers who are like, oh, I'm going to have, you know, it's like, as long as I make a good movie, I can have it be as complicated or confusing as I want, because people might return to it. And so I do just wonder, like, you know, I think there are filmmakers that are relying on people rewatching their movies. And then that, so I was thinking first about intentionality of the filmmaker, and then I started thinking about, you know, the audience, because obviously we're the ones that make the choice if we're going to rewatch something or not. And so then I started thinking, like, should we rewatch movies, you know, or should we just like see it one? Now obviously my answer is sure, why not, but I think we
as like film critics and cinephiles,
yeah,
do have a duty to rewatch movies.
Okay.
But I think I would say that most filmmakers from the beginning to today probably aren't intentionally trying to make a movie that you have to rewatch.
Mm.
There might be some, but I think most filmmakers are still,
right,
they still want, because I mean, the pre-advent of home video, let alone, yeah, streaming and stuff like that, it didn't stop Hitchcock from making Vertigo, which is,
sure,
an incredibly like texturally rich,
yeah, that's true,
film, you know.
But so, there was TV at that point. And okay, starting in the 50s and certainly in the 60s, you started to get contracts between networks and studios to start showing stuff on TV. Granted, you know, it's black and white instead of color and all that sort of thing. But don't get me wrong, I don't think Hitchcock would ever take that into account. I think he was just going to make whatever movie he wanted to make, regardless of its complexity or lack thereof. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
I don't think I have much more. I guess I'm more interested in this topic from the viewer's,
okay,
perspective, because I
yeah,
just
I'm
don't,
fine to shift to that. That's
but no,
fine.
If you have more to say about filmmakers, but it is my contention based on pure, like, I'm like George W. Bush here, going with my gut.
Sure.
That by and large, filmmakers are not intentionally making films that require repeat viewings.
All right, so now let me ask you this. Do you think studios might be invested in that?
No.
Do you think studios would want to make it just complex enough that a person might want to come back?
No, because not today, because studios, movies spend like, what, 3 weeks in theaters,
yeah,
and on streaming.
That's
everything's
true.
Just content. They don't,
yeah,
care. Like, they want you to subscribe to the streaming,
right,
the streaming platform.
That's, yeah, whether you click on this
stuff,
or that doesn't,
you know,
matter. As long as you're clicking.
Like, I've read that Netflix's algorithm, I don't know if this is true, this is speculation, that Netflix's algorithm, like, intentionally discourages rewatches. That it, like, it will not, if you're just browsing, it will not suggest something that you've watched all of recently. I don't know if that's true or not.
I mean, it sounds
true. Because I feel like there
true.
Is a watch it again category. Maybe there isn't anymore. But, yeah, I know that, like, I have to, like, when I finish watching BoJack, all of BoJack, and want,
yeah,
to start it over,
yeah,
the next week, I have to go search for it.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah, that tracks certainly. I'm fine to talk about from the viewer standpoint.
But I don't want to. If you had things to say about that, I don't want to stifle them.
It's more just kind of throwing questions out there about, like, you know, the way movies are shown. Is always going to have an impact on how they're made. And so, you know, first we had theatrical runs, and then we had like, oh, you can watch them on TV now. And then like, oh, now you can rent them. And now it's, oh, you can stream them. And so now I'm sure there are plenty of directors that, especially if it's like an independent film, they might think, oh, this might get a theatrical run. It might not. It might go someone, some streaming service might buy it up, and that's where it'll end up. And so in that instance, I do wonder if there are filmmakers, not that they're relying upon a rewatch, but if they're thinking in terms of like, this is not going to be watched in the traditional sense of the word. People can stop and start it. They can watch it over the course of several nights because they're busy. And if there is something that they feel like they missed, they can go back and rewatch that. Maybe not the whole movie, but just that. And I feel like there's got to be directors taking that into account.
I mean, hacks, maybe.
Well, yeah.
But I think it's more, well, it's definitely true because you reminded me of a story that I read about, and I had to look up who directed the Apple TV Plus film. Dexter Fletcher directed Ghosted with Chris Evans and Ana de Armas.
He directed that. Interesting.
Anyway.
Dexter Fletcher is not a bad director.
He said that Apple TV Plus scrapped his initial opening sequence, which was a long driving sequence of Ana de Armas, because they said on streaming, something needs to happen right away, or else people aren't going to stick. They basically have to have like action in 30 seconds, or else people aren't going to stick with it. So it was supposed to be this like helicopter shot following her driving through the like a mountain road or something,
like The Shining.
But I guess you can do that in a theatrical setting because people have like they've paid for the ticket and they're sitting there. They're a captive audience. With streaming, I guess you have to. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
But that I mean. I've always said that I'm one of those people who, like, quixotically, like, thinks that I will somehow eventually see every movie ever made.
Sure, of course.
But movies like Ghosted and Red Notice and The Gray Man and stuff like that, like, they don't even feel real to me. I don't really have any desire to see them.
Like, even when they have actors in there that I like and they're directed by filmmakers that I like, I totally agree with you. I haven't seen any of those. Red Notice did not interest me somehow. Gray Man interested me even less. And yeah, it just felt like, hey, or Extraction, that's another one. Where it's like, all right, let's just make this generic action movie because we need something. And it'll catch people's attention right away. And yeah, that's enough, right?
They actually did, peek behind the curtain, they did press screenings for Extraction 2.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting to think, like, they're showing... Critics are going to get to see it in the theater the way no one else will ever ever see it, as opposed to just like when I reviewed stuff for Netflix. I guess this was during COVID, but when I reviewed like The Old Guard or The Devil All the Time, like I got a link and I watched it at home the way that someone would watch it. But it's weird to like go. But shout out to we didn't talk about the strike ending. But yeah, shout out to our own very principled reviewer Scott Nye, who was supposed to go review Extraction 2. But it was at Netflix and he got there and there were picketers and he decided he didn't want to cross the picket line, which I fully support. I don't cross picket lines.
No, I would. I mean, you know, if there were if there was a critic strike, then certainly I wouldn't cross that.
But in solidarity, like, do you honk when you I guess you haven't been out about driving.
Yeah. I mean, there is a horn on my wheelchair.
Okay.
But I haven't been in a position to go on studio lots.
I have never in my life crossed a picket line. And I've... there's only a couple times that I've been faced with...
That possibility?
Yeah, one time Natalie and I canceled our hotel reservation and booked a hotel somewhere else because we found out the hotel workers were on strike.
Oh, okay.
And then... big memory, the week that my dad died, when I was home, the in St. Louis, the grocery workers union was on strike. So anytime it was like, oh, David, there's funerals and stuff, everything needs to be picked up. Like, David, can you get some whatever? I was going to like convenience stores and gas stations and probably paying too much.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It was because I don't cross picket lines. And I'm very glad that the actor strike is over for a lot of reasons, but one of them being that I occasionally have to go on to studio lots for my job.
Yeah.
And if it came to that, that would be like a really difficult decision.
Oh, that's true.
For me. So luckily it never came to that. I never had to choose not to cross a SAG or WGA picket line. But yes, I never crossed the picket line in my life. I hope to keep it that way.
I don't think I've ever been in the position to do it or not. There is this tendency in me to be like, well, I don't have anything to do with this. And like the idea of solidarity, it's like, that appeals to me.
Yeah.
But it appeals to me, but it doesn't occur to me. And also, I feel like when it comes right down to it, how hard did you need to twist Scott's arm to not see Extraction 2? If anything, I'm sure he's like, oh, like it, maybe it was just like a crowd of people and he thought it was them. He's like, good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I actually have an upcoming screening at Netflix for May, December. Italian's movie. And so that's mostly I'm happy the picket line, the strike has ended for the actors and everything. Yeah. But a part of me is like, phew, I don't have to worry about that.
Well, and then here's a stupid part of me is I'm thinking in terms of our awards draft. And, you know, when actors are striking, they can't do any publicity.
Yeah.
And so there was talk that some of the movies that like we all selected in our awards draft might be pushed to the following year because the actors weren't able to do any publicity. So now that that's done, I don't have to worry about changing my picks anytime soon.
Do you remember, does anyone in our, by the way, if you want to hear about me and Tyler and Scott's draft picks, sign up for the Patreon. Patreon.com/battleshipretention. Sign up at the $5 or $10 level because we only get one episode a month of the $2 level, and I already did the November one, so you won't. But the second episode of November, we are going to be, we've already recorded it, running down the three of our teams.
Cool.
But that reminds me, I'm trying to remember if anyone had selected anything for the Bike Riders, the new Jeff Nichols movie?
I don't believe so.
Okay, because that, I think, officially no longer has a U.S. release date. It was supposed to be early December.
Oh, okay.
And then they pushed it to late December at first, and then I noticed, because I'm looking for, like, For Your Consideration awards, like screenings right now.
Right.
And Disney's, because it's a 20th century picture, Disney's FYC page, the Bike Rider disappeared from it. Mm. But now I'm wondering, because they didn't move it to anything, they just took it off the schedule.
Yeah.
Maybe now that the strike's over, they'll put it back on the schedule.
Yeah, it's because, possible.
As Scott pointed out, I can't remember if this is on podcast, on an episode or off the episode, like one of the main things, you know, in terms of marketing and publicity that movie has going for it is that it has this great cast with Austin Butler and Jodie Comer and Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
Mike Faced. I don't know if Mike Faced is a big draw to other people, but people who saw West Side Story really like him. Michael Shannon's in it, of course, because it's a Jeff Nichols movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, also,
with a cast that big and it being like an actor-led film, then if they can't do any publicity, you might as well push it until they can.
And in case anyone listening didn't listen to the AFI Fest wrap-up, or at least didn't listen to all 2 hours and 45 minutes of it, I liked The Bike Riders quite a bit, which surprised me because I haven't liked a Jeff Nichols movie in some time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Loving was bad. And
it was bad, really. Was bad. A lot of people really liked it.
Well,
you're not a lot of people.
Yeah. Anyway, we are so far off topic. Yeah. That's
so
okay.
So one thing that I wanted to mention.
But we were talking about streamers. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm happy to pivot at this point. Okay. I feel like I've talked about that as much as I am able. But, you know, you mentioned the George W. Bush attitude of, like, going with your gut.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll tell this story. I remember back when we were in college at Columbia College Chicago, and is everything okay?
I think so.
Okay, just making sure.
Well, everything looks. I'm looking at the readout. We've had problems. We had a problem once where my mic
cut out
completely like early in the episode and stayed out the rest of the episode.
Man.
And I had sort of levelized it and kind of fixed it a little bit. But yes, I have been keeping an eye on the readout here.
Okay. Well, if you want, you can snuggle up here with me, and if your mic goes out, you can use mine.
Yeah.
So I remember I was in a class called Acting for Filmmakers. And so we were all, you know, we would all act.
Acting for directors?
I think it was officially called Acting for Filmmakers.
All right. I would argue that actors are filmmakers, but...
Oh, that's true, yeah. Maybe it was acting for directors, but anyway. And so we were all acting in each other's stuff, and then at the end of the semester, the teacher would, like, meet with us one-on-one and give us, like, an evaluation of our films and our ability to work with people and our acting. And I remember the teacher said, he said, "You are maybe the most instinctive actor that I've ever met." And I was like, "All right." And he said, "Now, normally, that's not a great thing." He goes, "But your instincts are good." And I was like, "All right, well, that's good." It still feels like I need to be cautious. But that's the thing, is I think that's very much who I am, is like someone who approaches art, whether it be like creating it or talking about it, is that first and foremost, I go with my instinct, which is why, you know, we've talked about the fact that I do not take notes when I'm going to be reviewing a movie.
Yeah, you're in good company. Scott doesn't take notes.
Yeah.
I know our friend of the show, Katie Walsh, is a big no-note taker.
Do you know, have they given reasons why?
I don't remember, but like, I love to take notes.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is for me, my thought is, even though a critic has a different role to play than your average audience member, I feel like, well, the audience isn't taking notes, you know, and they're, whatever's staying in their head as they leave the movie, like, that's just how movies are. And so I want to try and recreate that myself so that, like, whatever I'm left thinking about, it's like, all right, well, I guess that's the impression the film made on me. And so, I mean, and later I'll do research into, like, character names that I forgot or whatever, but
that's the other thing. That's part of what I take notes for, is, like, little shorthand, like, scene descriptions or write down lines of dialogue to make sure I don't forget them. If there's a line of dialogue I want to reference, I write it down.
And that's the thing, is, like, in my mind, if I forgot it, it wasn't that memorable in the first place. I'm putting a lot of stock in my own memory, apparently.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's the thing, is I think I approach movies in a very, I mean, it will become intellectual as I discuss them, but in the moment, it's very instinctive. And so when I think about that, when it comes to, like, rewatchability, there is this feeling of, and when I say it out loud, it sounds really stupid, even to me, but, you know, that's the nature of an academic discussion. Most of the stuff you're going to say is pretty stupid. You know, like when I was getting my master's degree, I would just be like, oh boy, we're all a bunch of fucking morons, until the last 5 minutes of class, and it's like, oh no, wait, we're all geniuses. But no, like I instinctively feel like I should approach every movie as though I'm only going to see it once, for whatever reason. And so, like, and I'm going to get what I can get out of it the first time. And if what I can, you know, and if what I get out of it is not much, then I kind of see that as like, all right, that's the fault of the filmmaker, not me. And then, of course, there are some movies, like, I remember I saw Gosford Park, and I didn't like it very much. Then I saw it again, because I was intrigued, and I liked it a little more. And then I saw it a third time, because Jen wanted to see it, and then I loved it. Now, I don't think Altman is relying on that, but I think he absolutely, like, with his overlapping dialogue, there are so many lines, and one could say entire storylines, that are kind of thrown away, and they reward repeat viewings. But it's like, yeah, but if it's not going to reward that on first viewing, because you cannot guarantee that anyone's going to watch this again. So it's like, if you have an impression to make, you should try to make it on the first viewing.
But I don't think that's, I think that's you, not Alton.
I know, that's...
Because I had not a much different movie. But at AFI Fest, whatever year this would have been, 2018, maybe, I saw the movie Vox Lux.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
With Natalie Portman. And I think I gave it a bad review. Or at least on the podcast I did. I didn't like it. But Scott liked it. And often when, like, I feel like when you or Scott, the two people I talk about movies with the most, have a differing opinion than I do, it does get me intrigued to, like, maybe I'm wrong. Sure. That's also my self-doubt of being like, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, fact, I feel exactly the same when you disagree or Scott disagrees with me.
But, so between the fact that Scott liked it and the fact that I found myself continuing to think about it,
yeah,
there were things that, like, I couldn't dismiss.
Yeah.
I went back and watched it again, and it was like a completely different movie almost. Yeah. Now I would say I think Vox Lux is pretty great. And so that could have just been my headspace at the time. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, so much.
Change over time as well.
Exactly.
You know? I've been talking about, I need to rewatch. So I famously, to listeners of this podcast, famously, was a Fincher skeptic up until Zodiac.
Right.
But Seven is the only pre-Zodiac Fincher that I've revisited since Zodiac. And I've revisited Seven multiple times. Cause,
yeah.
I mean, we talk about, like, you use the phrase rewatchable, which is a little bit like, any movie that's available to watch is available to rewatch.
Right.
But, like, I think that gets back to that comfort food thing.
Yeah.
Like, which is weird that, like, violent movies like Goodfellas and Seven and No Country for Old Men are my comfort food.
But it's, you know, it's all about how it's done.
Yeah, yeah. Seven is so satisfying. Yeah. But
Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, however, is not very rewatchable.
No, there's although nothing, I have seen it twice.
There's nothing comforting about that movie.
Yeah. So I've been meaning to rewatch, like, everything from Alien 3 to The Game, which I forget about, Fight Club, and Panic Room. I've been meaning to rewatch all those because I know that I'm different now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I actually feel similar about Fight Club. I liked it at first, and then I turned 18 and didn't like it as much. And I think I just kind of dismissed it partially because of my mindset. But I was 17, you know? And so if I were to rewatch it now, I think I'd probably I'd probably like it more than officially do.
It's interesting how I feel like my opinion of a movie can change sometimes without me rewatching it, or like you were saying, you feel like you would like it more.
Yeah.
A movie, very different movie, but speaking of that certain time in your life, when I saw it in the theater, I did not like Peyton Reed's Bring It On.
Oh, okay.
And I have not seen it since.
Yeah.
But when I think about why I didn't like it, I think, oh, the reasons I didn't like it are probably what I would find interesting now.
Yeah.
Which is mostly, the thing I remember thinking at the time was, like, being frustrated by the movie's ambivalence about the world it's depicting. It seems to go back and forth between mocking cheerleading and celebrating cheerleading as a pursuit. Yeah. And I think I would find that much more interesting.
Yeah, if anything, it's like, I think that's the only way to approach it, right?
Yeah. But I guess at the time I wanted it to be one or the other because I was less developed as a person when I was newly 18 when that movie came out.
You and I saw Mulholland Drive together, and I didn't like it because at the time I was very much a kind of story and character guy, especially, you know, really well-structured movies. And so I didn't really, I mean, it was gorgeous, of course.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't deny that. But I didn't really respond to it. Same when I saw last year at Marion Bad.
Real quick, if listeners, if you want to hear my version of the first time we saw Mulholland Drive, sign up for the Patreon. Oh. It came up on a recent Fun Game.
Oh, Fun Game. Oh, cool.
Well, you know, because
where did we see it? The Three Penny?
Yeah, Three Penny, which is not in operation anymore. I mean, I think it's still in operation as a venue. It's not a movie theater
anymore. Oh, that's too bad.
Which I looked up on the, but I don't know if you know about the Patreon, because you and I used to do a TV journal every week or every month. Scott doesn't watch enough TV, so we've been doing a Fun Game every single month.
Sure.
In fact, in October we did two.
Oh man,
we did a regular one and then we did a horror only edition.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh man, I got to subscribe to this Patreon.
Yeah, everyone should.
Yeah. Listeners, come and join me.
Yeah.
How was I talking about?
Mulholland Drive, and then you said last year, Marion Bad.
Last year, Werckmeister Harmonies, you know, which is now
not one of your favorite movies.
It's in my top 10, and it's not It's not going to go away anytime soon.
You were so mad at me for dragging you to that.
Well,
on New Year's Eve.
It was also New Year's Eve.
Perfect New Year's Eve
movie. And like, I believe I had driven up from Springfield to St. Louis, and then you and I flew, right? Did we fly to Chicago?
We definitely did that once. But that might have been, we might have been both like...
Either way, I was exhausted. And that movie is not the one to watch when you're exhausted, especially when you're 19. Yeah. And so, but no, since then, I've watched a couple more times, and I think it's an absolute masterpiece. And so I do think, you know, you bring something up that I didn't think about, which is like, you know, I think when people rewatch a movie, it's because they want to re-engage with the emotions that the film made you feel, or step into a specific world. Like, that's why I watch Lord of the Rings as often as I do, because it's such a completely developed world that I enjoy stepping into. But there is that other thing, which is, the movie might not change, but we change. You know, like, I'm sure there are, and I've said this before, but like, I'm sure there are any number of movies that I would, that I did not like when I did not have kids, that I might like a lot more now that I, or at least understand more that I, now that I do have kids. Like, I haven't seen Kramer versus Kramer since becoming a father, and I have a feeling it would have a pretty big impact on me now. And I loved it then, you know? So that idea of thinking like, well, what's something I didn't like when I thought I knew everything at 17? I should revisit it. Maybe I'm right, and maybe more likely I'm wrong.
I think I'm glad you brought that up, because I was also going to bring up the idea that I think most like non-movie people, the only reason they is adults, non-movie adults, kids rewatch movies over and over.
Oh my, yes, I know.
The question recently with friends, the question of what's the movie you've seen the most often, the most times, came up, and my answer is always Die Hard. But I'm not counting like Willow or An American Tale or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which I watched all the time as kids. Those are probably, as a kid, those are probably higher on the list than I want to admit. But anyway.
Well, see, that's why Jaws works for me. Okay. I watched it when I was young and now.
But I think most non-movie people, adults, just like lay people, adults, they are only rewatching movies for the reasons you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're revisiting something that they expect to not feel differently about. They want to get that same thing back, or they watch it for a special occasion, you know, or this is the movie we watch at Christmas or whatever like that. But I do think there is some value in that too. Like, I don't think that's a lesser form of.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to devalue it.
Like, I, there is a certain amount of like engaging with art that like affects your brain and your emotions in a similar way to a drug. So sometimes there is like, I liked the feeling I got watching that movie. Like, there's a certain sort of like sublimation or catharsis or release or whatever. I've certainly watched, I've watched Support the Girls multiple times because it's like, it's so fun and funny. And then the end of it, I don't know, have you seen Support the Girls?
No, not yet.
The end of it is such a, like a big, like there's a release at the end. And it does feel like I'm chasing the, conversely, last year and this year were the first Octobers in a long time that I didn't rewatch The Ring. I used to rewatch The Ring every October. And I found that it wasn't affecting me. Like, the, I still appreciate the movie, but it was almost like, big smokers, big pot smokers having to like take a month off to reset.
I like smart pokers.
Big pot smokers having to take a month off to like reset their like sensitivity or whatever. That's kind of where I am with The Ring. Is like, I love The Ring. I will always love The Ring, but it stopped giving me chills. So I need to like let that build back up.
Maybe
next October I'll rewatch The Ring again.
I've been thinking about that myself. It's like, there are movies I'm like, oh, you know what? I haven't seen that in a while. It's like, yeah, but you saw it so much that I don't think it's going to have that same impact. Like LA Confidential. Like, I haven't seen that in probably 10 years.
Yeah.
But before that, I watched it regularly.
Yeah.
And it was probably, like, it's nothing against the movie. It's that, I probably need an even longer reset.
slightly off topic, but very much on that topic. Natalie and I were also talking recently about, well, like, songs that you know are good and you like, but you don't, like, need to hear anymore. Okay. You know, like, I threw out, like, Lose Yourself by Eminem.
Sure.
Like, good song, but, yeah. Like, I've heard it so many times that I don't think there's anything new there. Even a song that a band that I love, but, like, Blister in the Sun by the Violent Femmes. Like, I've heard that enough. And there's plenty of other Violent Femmes songs that I like even more. I don't need to hear Blister in the Sun again. I don't know if you have any.
Honestly. I'm going to say the Johnny Cash version of Hurt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's wonderful. And the video still elicits emotion for me. Yeah. You've never seen the video? No. Well, obviously.
Mark Romanek?
Yeah. And no, I believe it was voted by Rolling Stone as, like, the best music video of all time.
Wow.
Now, obviously, once we stop recording, we're going to watch it.
Okay.
I'm insisting.
Did Rolling Stone not watch the Steal My Sunshine by Len video?
I know. It's,
Well, genuine contender for favorite music video of all time is 1979 by Smashing Pumpkins.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
Now, of course, how much did you come to appreciate it after you became a film historian?
What, 1979?
That's the one with, like...
Oh, no, you're thinking of Tonight.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Which I should probably rewatch. A dude on the subway, like a busker on the subway, was singing Tonight with the acoustic guitar the other morning. It was like, oh, what a great song. Yeah. I haven't listened to that in so
now
long.
Now I'm struggling to remember the video for 1979.
Oh, it's kind of like, it's like... a bunch of kids, like, kind of Dazed and Confused-ish, like, having a party or whatever.
That's right.
And then each of the band members plays a different, like, adult they encounter. Like, Darcy is, like, the neighbor who's like, turn that down. And James Iha is, like, the convenience store. They, like, buy beer with a fake ID. And
that's James right. Iha.
Yeah. It's a very fun video.
Yeah. And, of course, there's always Tom Waits' I Don't Want to Grow Up, where...
He sits under a table?
Yeah, like, the camera is just, like... looking at this, I forget if it's empty, but basically it's like this bar, and then it settles in on one table with a tablecloth, and then zooms down, and the tablecloth opens like curtains, and there's Tom Waits huddled under the table with what looks like a ukulele and just sings the whole song. I forget who directed that.
We're way off topic, but yeah. Another Smashing Pumpkins one that is... really fascinating in its execution is the song Ava Adore, which is just like Billy like walking through. It's a bunch of like almost like a side scroller video game, a bunch of different scenes that he's walking through as he's singing along.
Yeah.
But the camera, or not the camera, I guess in post production, it will sometimes speed up or sometimes go into slow motion.
Oh, nice.
But they had to plan it all out so that Billy lip syncing to the song always stays the same. So like if they knew, hey, starting here, the camera's going to speed up, you're going to have to start singing the song very slowly so that it matches in post. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
There's like a, cause I have the like, music video collection DVD and there's like a making of.
Oh, that's cool. And I gotta say, I am a sucker for those OK Go things. Those like Rube Goldbergian type things.
Yeah.
Where I guess it's, I mean, obviously the camera work has to be spot on, but there's no editing. So I guess it's more just a feat of choreography. Yeah. But yeah, so going back to the topic. Yeah, I do think, there is this, I mean, it's kind of sad to mention it, but like there are movies that can make us feel things that we literally have never felt because of just the nature of life, you know, like
childbirth.
To bring like, well, I suppose so. But I mean, like, I'll use a recent example. You know, I'm a speaking of things I'm a sucker for. In Avengers Endgame, when Captain America gets that fucking hammer, man, oh man, that worked for me. And it's such a specific moment.
It was such a big eye roll for me.
Oh, man.
But
I liked it just because, like, it's like, oh, they've kind of been setting that up for several years. And I also like that, like, he not only gets it, but he uses it well. like,
yeah,
in coordination with his shield. So I like that.
I like, you said they set it up for several years, but I think what's fascinating about it is I don't think when Joss Whedon put that joke in Age of Ultron, he was thinking this.
No,
I think
probably they, not.
You know, the Russos sort of picked up on something that had been seeded, yeah, and like, I do like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I guess as far as eye roll moments in Avengers Endgame, at least it isn't as annoying as the like girl power.
I know.
And it's so like condescending, I feel like.
And it's just one of those things where like, it's like, I get what you're doing, and on one hand, I'm in favor of it. On the other hand, when it's like, oh, Captain Marvel has help. Pretty sure Captain Marvel doesn't need any help, and she especially is not going to get a lot of help from fucking Mantis. You know what I mean? Like, she should not be on the battlefield at all.
God, just okay. So I'll talk about MCU movies and okay. Captain Marvel. I think we talked about this off mic at the time.
Yeah.
But now enough time has passed that we could talk kind of spoilers.
Yeah.
Doctor Strange 2.
Yeah.
Are we to assume that the Captain Marvel in that alternate universe, yeah, has the same powers as the Captain Marvel in our universe? And if so, how does a statue fall on, yeah, her kill her? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I would assume it's the same thing. But yeah, that does seem... I actually rewatched that Doctor Strange. And yeah, that's that moment is just like, I don't know. Seems pretty, kind of goes out like a chump here.
Because in real life,
yeah,
in Earth Prime, whatever they call it, like MCU, in the real world of our MCU movies,
yeah,
a statue falls on Captain Marvel, she barely, yeah, feels it. It's gonna,
exactly.
It's going to be like the dude at the end of the Rabbit in Your Headlights video when the car hits him. Do you remember that?
I don't think I remember that one.
We definitely watched it together.
It's, oh, did we? Oh, okay. I don't have a great memory for music videos, unfortunately.
Right. Well,
but
yeah, check out the Rabbit in Your Headlights by Uncle. It's a cool video.
But all that is to say, like, you know, whether it be Avengers or whatever, but like, there are these really inspiring moments that are so, just the nature of them is just so heightened that like very little in my life, certainly these days, but very little in my life can like create that level of exhilaration in me. Obviously, of course, like, I love when my kids were born, but that's a very different kind of feeling. It's not a feeling of triumph, mm-hmm, you know? And so, you know, when people do talk about escapism, I certainly don't downplay the importance of that when watching movies. Because, yeah, like, sometimes our lives just don't lend themselves to, like, a lot of really great cheering moments. But then we watch a movie and it's like, oh, I felt that. And I think I want to feel that again. Like, I think you're right to say it's similar to a drug in that regard.
Yeah. But what do you think of the idea? We should probably wrap up pretty soon.
Yeah.
What do you think of the idea of... And I guess this could apply to watching a movie for the first time or rewatching a movie, but doing it as a sort of self-assigned homework, I'm okay with it. A lot of movies I watch because I'm like, I've assigned myself to watch this movie.
Right.
But I don't know if that's...
But have you ever assigned yourself something that you genuinely don't think you'll like? You know, outside of, you know, Triumph of the Will or Birth of a Nation or something.
No, I've never seen Birth of a Nation. I have seen Triumph of the Will in a school context.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I must have watched or rewatched movies that I can't think of any examples, though.
Yeah, like, because I do think that there are movies that I'm not naturally inclined to watch, but if I know that they're really well-respected... Then it's like, all right, well, I should watch it. But also, if it's as good as everyone says, there's a good chance that I'll like it, you know? So my own preferences do play a role. And so it's like, I need to overcome my natural preferences. But in doing so, I'm also recognizing, like, there's a very good chance I could like this. But you know what? I will say, sometimes you gotta rewatch a movie to know that you like it, and sometimes you gotta rewatch a movie to confirm that you do not. I've said this before. I have fucking given Tombstone every chance I can get. Every chance I can give it. Like, so many men of our age are like, oh, Tombstone, it's so great. And my thing is like, you like Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
The rest of the movie's fine. You like Val Kilmer. Fine. Yeah. He's great in it, sure. But let's not mistake one performance for the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then I will say...
Oh, also, Val Kilmer, also costumes. Great costumes in Tombstone. I think that goes a long way.
That's true, yeah. I mean, it doesn't feel overly polished, but it certainly doesn't, you know, came out around the same time as Unforgiven. And it's like, Yeah, those are two very different Westerns. Yeah. Yeah. But I will say, I rewatched a movie, and this is going to be one that I feel like I might get some flack for. And I think I've said it on the show before, but I keep giving it a chance, and I think I might be done giving it chances. And that is The Shining.
Oh.
I recognize how beautifully composed it is. I recognize the pacing, the sense of dread, and yet somehow I'm not invested. I don't like what Jack Nicholson's doing. And it just feels like a very muddled movie to me. Like, it focuses so much on Jack's insanity that it's like, okay, yes, but this is also supposed to be like a haunted hotel. And it feels like that aspect of it, to say nothing of The Shining itself, really does seem to be pushed to the side in favor of like, oh, this guy's gone crazy. Oh, wait, he's always been crazy. You know, and just after a while, I don't know, it just leaves me pretty cold.
That's a bummer to hear, because, I find the movie really haunting and beautiful. Yeah. Weirdly, it just came up in conversation last night because Natalie said it might be the scariest movie she's ever seen.
And a lot of people say that. And that is definitely not how it works for me. Although it does not keep me from enjoying Room 237, made by friend of the show Rodney Asher. Which I also
made The Nightmare scariest movie I've ever seen.
Boy, oh boy. That's a rough one. I think for my own personal reasons, the scariest movie I've ever seen is Arachnophobia. Because it might not be the scariest made movie, but when you are an arachnophobic, as I am, that movie will ruin your life. Maybe the rest of your life. You know, you and I have talked about, like, you can't reach underneath a lampshade.
I mean, without, I can, but well, I think yeah, about it. Yeah.
But your mind's going to go to that immediately.
Yeah, but I don't have the fear of spiders that you have.
No, not many people do. Although I took a psychology class once, and they talked about, like, an irrational fear of spiders. In which case, like, there was this one woman who refused to open her kitchen cabinets because she was sure that they were so full of spiders that when she opened it, they would just, this wall of spiders would fall on her. And so I was like, all right.
I think that goes beyond arachnophobia.
I think that goes, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's more stuff at play there. But yeah, so I'm trying to think if there was anything else that I wanted to talk about. Obviously, like, I'm not going to stop rewatching movies. I'm not coming out in favor or against it. Probably more in favor if I had to choose.
Yeah, I would say.
But it's more just kind of, it's just something we all do. Yeah. And I feel like it never hurts to dig into why and, like, what we hope to achieve, if we hope to achieve anything. And then, like, doing it, like, we do it instinctively, but it's like, well, maybe let's dig into why we're rewatching a specific movie. You know, like, my favorite movie of all time is Nashville. You'd think that means I've seen it a ton of times. No, I've seen it like 4 times, maybe 5, since first seeing it 21 years ago. You know? And then, like, same with Citizen Kane. Up until I started teaching film classes, I think I had only seen Citizen Kane probably, like, 6 times. And then Jaws, however, which is my number three, that one easily, it's probably getting close to 100. And so a lot of people would probably say, like, well, obviously that's your favorite movie. And it's like, somehow that's not the case. And
yeah, there are other factors.
And there's other factors.
Die Hard is easily and it's the movie I've seen the most.
Yeah.
Not counting all the movies I watched over and over as a kid.
Right.
But Die Hard isn't even my top 10 movies. It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's great.
And like the other movies I've seen a bunch of times, Days of Confused, Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah.
These are probably my top 100 movies of all time.
Yeah.
But they're not.
Yeah. I feel like we could do a whole separate episode on rewatchability and what that means. What makes a movie, like, first defining it. And then determining, like, what is it that makes a movie rewatchable?
Well, yeah. Well, maybe the topic and should be, and listeners can tell us if we already did this, comfort movies.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Feels like one we've done already, but you never know.
Yeah. I have other ideas for topics that I will talk to you about off mic.
Okay.
I'm not going to give away our gold here.
Indeed.
You can find us at battleshippretension.com. It's also where you can find the Patreon. I'm really plugging the Patreon today, patreon.com/battleshippretension. There's that. You can find Scott's been reviewing movies like Madman over at battleshippretention.com.
Yeah, Rudy's quite literally. He's just like, he's just flinging his fingers at the keys. Like, there's no actual words in there.
Yeah.
It's very, a lot
well,
of,
he thinks
a
his
lot
computer's
of,
full of spiders.
A lot of windings.
Rudy's been doing home video reviews for us. That's been great.
Yeah.
You can find my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, there. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about Matthew Perry recently. You can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Davey Pretension. Email me at david@battleshippretension.com. I'm on Letterboxd at David Backs. You can find me. Tyler, where can people find you?
You can follow me on Twitter at morelessons. That's the one that I use more actively because I'm more personal on that one. So you can follow me if you want to see like silly movie observations and the depths of despair.
Yeah, that's
so
one or the other.
One or the other.
Yeah,
not much in between. But also, I've been writing for there's this streaming service called Rediscover Television. I've talked about it before. And they started a blog that at the moment is just me. But I'm really happy with a lot of the stuff I've been writing on there. I just wrote like a little summary of like what film noir is. And then I recently wrote a review for Five Nights at Freddy's. And I wrote a lot of stuff about horror movies back in October. So if you just search for Rediscover Television and blog, you should be able to find it and read all my stuff there.
All right. Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.